Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report, now part of InvestSmart, finance presenter on ABC News and a columnist for The New Daily.
And I'm Stephen Mayne, contributor at Intelligent Investor, founder of Crikey, shareholder, advocate and City of Manningham councillor.
And we are
The Money Cafe. Well,
Stephen, hello. And
you sound a bit croaky. I mean, you've been partying too hard or something.
I'm a bit croaky. I think I'm coming down with a cold somehow.
That's the boring, truthful answer.
I have a book club last night. Just two glasses of wine. No, it wasn't a party.
Did you talk a lot though? Do you get a bit crook from just going too hard? Like, it was a late night.
After 9 p.m.
I can't say, your bedtime.
I wouldn't say that I dominated last night.
Unlike the Money Cafe.
No.
All right. Well, you better start dominating me today, Alan. Sam Mostyn. What do you think?
Yeah, so I just wanted to let you know, Stephen, that, you know, when I started Business Spectator in 2007...
I had the scoop. You rang me up and gave me the scoop.
There you are. Did I?
Actually, you gave me the scoop with Eureka Report.
Okay, so Eureka Report was 2005. 2 years later, we started Business Spectator.
Yes.
And about a year after that, I decided to put together a advisory board. And Sam Mostyn
was on it.
Did us the honour of going on our advisory board.
First and only female member of the advisory board.
Oh, absolutely not. No. In fact, one of the other members of the advisory board was Margaret Gardner, who is now the governor of Victoria.
We had a couple of
future governors on our advisory board.
Wow.
And some other terrific people as well. The advisory board met for a few years at every quarter, once a quarter, and we...
You paid them?
No.
Oh, Alan.
No, we paid well. We bought them dinner. We had dinner.
Okay.
And we paid them with dinner. But anyway, they were delighted to be part of the show and to just help us get our thoughts together, and every quarter we made up a little presentation of how we were going, and
that's good because that would have been because she exited executive life in 2008 when she finished up at Insurance Australia Group, so she went full time professional director.
That was that time
as she was making the pivot,
and she was trying to become a
professional director.
A professional director, and obviously she saw the Business Spectator Advisory Board as a bit of a stepping stone.
Well, she's stepped a long way now, hasn't she? Goodness
me. Yes, and it turned out to be a good stepping stone, let's face it.
Yes, because her first corporate – so obviously the AFL was her first sort of high-profile part-time gig while she was still a senior executive at IAG. She then joined Virgin and Transurban. They were her big two. And she had 4 years at Covermore, and then she joined Mervac in 2015. So she peaked at four, and then she's down just to the one now. But what I like about her career is that she's always not overdone the corporate gigs. She's always done a lot of not-for-profit, mental health, climate, a whole bunch of other stuff.
No, she's a very committed woman. I think she's a fantastic appointment.
Yeah.
Really.
I agree. I actually got in trouble with her. I had a go at her at the 2013 Virgin AGM, where I challenged the fact that they were doing this dodgy capital raising where retail shareholders were diluted out of $50 million worth of stock, and they'd limited us retail shareholders from applying for additional shares at 40% of entitlement. And I took them to the takeovers panel over this, and I actually had a go at her at the meeting and said, have you done this just because the three big airlines, which own 63%, want to be able to creep and increase their stake from retail shareholders? And they were so furious that I could question her integrity. The chairman wrote to the chairman of the ASA, and how dare you suggest that Sam, who's wonderful, could possibly not act in the best interest of retail shareholders?
I'm shocked, Stephen, that you would do that, honestly.
So I got in trouble, but I still think she's a great appointment. I think that all the attacks are pathetic. Well, there's not many attacks. There's a couple of just dial-a-quote Murdoch types who are having a whinge, but... I think she'll do great.
She's
calling her a
coverage.
Lefty, and
Labour
political baggage and quota.
She's the wokest possible Governor General, honestly.
It's such a joke. I mean, Sam Mostyn is literally an AICD cover girl. She was on the cover of the Institute of Company Directors magazine in 2017. I mean, she's been on the board of Transurban, Virgin. I mean, you know, Mervac. I mean, she's a property developer. I mean, she's not some. Yes, she did work for Keating and Bob Collins and Michael Lee in the early days of pay TV, but that is more than 20 years ago. Yeah. So anyway, I think it's a great appointment.
Now, what do you think of Seven and Bruce Lehman's travails? Come
well,
on.
Well, I was actually quoted on AM this morning on the ABC calling into question the suitability of Kerry Stokes to remain in control of Seven. And whether it's time he got out and the regulators stepped in because...
Will you just?
It's a government licence. I mean, you can't have shareholder funds being used to pay for prostitutes and, you know, all this sort of stuff going on. It's just... I mean, checkbook journalism is bad enough. Checkbook journalism in the shape of this is disgusting. So I think that at some point the culture at Seven, you know, after... Tim Warner and Amber Harrison and Ben Robert Smith. And I mean, what is Kerry Stokes doing? What is he allowing to happen?
He's doing whatever he bloody well feels like doing.
I just think I'm sick of billionaires owning or controlling media. I think media should be one of those, like the old gambling rules, that no one can own more than 5%. And it must be widely owned because it's too important. You just can't have one billionaire presiding over a culture like this. So I think he should go, Stokes. You know, with my 10 shares, I'll be voting against him when he's next up for election at Seven West Media.
I mean, he'll be devastated to learn this, Stephen.
Yes,
you
yes.
know.
But what do you make of it all, Alan?
Oh, look, I think it's appalling, really. I mean, that's kind of doesn't surprise me. And it's this sort of stuff. I mean, television. What did someone say?
Tabloid television.
Tabloid television is a trench through journalism.
Yes.
It's terrible. I mean, honestly.
My 90-year-old aunt was on a current affair the other night complaining about a development in her backyard in Yamba. And I was going, oh, be careful, Auntie Joan, you know, you're dealing with a current affair. But it was fine at the end. But I agree, just the culture in particularly that Today Tonight, a current affair culture is just terrible. Has been for a long time.
I mean, it's worth bearing in mind remembering that Bruce Lehman actually brought this case. The reason this case is happening is because he sued 10. I mean, you know, and it's kind of blowing up repeatedly in his face.
Mm-hmm.
Dear, oh dear.
Yep. So I think it's good.
Now, you want to talk about takeover frenzies, and what about Austal being bid for by Hanwha, the Korean company?
Yeah, look, this is very interesting because, I mean, we've had this ridiculous, you know, 50 takeovers since 2019, and there's literally 19 major takeovers that have been announced this year. Three have completed, another 16 in the works. We've never seen a takeover frenzy like it. And I actually reckon that the government won't allow Austal to fall into foreign hands, even a friendly country like South Korea. It's our only listed shipbuilding capacity. It's got lots of big military contracts. I think they should just say to the South Koreans, look, we love you, your partners, you know, you've got a big plant at Geelong, you're in our defence procurement system, but we don't want you to spend $1 billion buying our only listed sort of boat builder with big defence contracts with both the US and Australia.
Well, I'm waiting to hear what Andrew Forrest says because he owns 15% of the company.
Oh, not 19. He's a patriot. He will not allow.
He owns 19, does he?
Yeah, and the CEO founder, John Rothwell's got 9. So between those two, it's in their hands.
Yeah, that's right. And so presumably they won't sell.
Yeah, I just think they'd just say no. I mean, it's just as simple as that. So, but I think this is, you know, like CSL is one of the few stocks that literally can't be taken over because of legislation and constitutional constraints on foreign ownership and size of individual shareholdings. It does raise the question, which other companies would not be taken over? Like, would the government actually block any foreign player from buying? I mean, I think probably big four banks they wouldn't allow, ASX, BHP, you know, if someone tried to buy BHP, would that get blocked by the government?
No.
No?
No.
Macquarie?
No.
I reckon if Goldman Sachs bid for Macquarie, would the government go, yeah, no worries at all.
Macquarie's hardly an Australian company. It's,
well, yeah. But,
you know, it happens to be based here.
But it's an Australian champion. So Austal is our only major, you know, successful ship, you know, defence company, and we need more Austals, not less. So I think that Twiggy should just do the patriotic thing and say, I'm not selling at any price. Go away.
Yeah, fair enough.
Now, before we actually get on to questions, Alan, I want to mention that the AGM season, mini season for December 31 companies is starting today. We've got the Centre Group AGM at
what proportion of companies?
10 o'clock.
What proportion of companies are December 31? Do you know?
It would be 10 to 20%.
Right.
So you do get a few, you know, you've got the AMP, Woodside, you know, Santos, Illumina, TPG. There's quite, you know, it's quite a pleasant season because it's not feral, but there's enough to feed on if you're looking for a bit of red meat to get stuck in a few companies. I quite enjoy
it. As you are,
April
of course.
And May. April and May is my favourite months of the year because it's not frenetic, but there's enough red meat that can keep an activist satisfied.
So. You're a carnivore, Stephen.
So,
when it comes to AGMs,
So I just want to name
blood dripping
check.
Down your chin.
Yes, I just want to name check. Santos, Latitude, Azure, which is a lithium play getting taken over, ERA, Woodside, Smart Group, and TPG. This coming mini season,
ERA,
all of them,
is ERA still with us?
Still listed. They've just awarded
honestly
a contract to Rio Tinto to,
how did they
to,
stay
to rehabilitate.
On
well, they're just spending $2 billion rehabilitating all the uranium mines up in the Northern Territory.
Are they? Where'd they get that from?
Rio Tinto. When Rio bought North, they bought control of ERA. Now they own 87%, and
yeah, right.
The minority shareholders want them sell the uranium, and Rio just wants to clean it up because they're so scarred from Juukan Gorge. They don't want to risk being seen to be profiting from uranium, so they're not letting them sell or develop any of the prospects. They're just saying we're going to spend $2 billion cleaning it up, and we're not going to develop the other prospects up there. But anyway, those companies, none of them are offering hybrid AGMs. They're all making you turn up, and that is disgusting in 2024.
Disgusting.
So well done, Centre Group. 10 o'clock, hybrid AGM. I'll be sitting there in Manningham firing questions online because I can't travel to Sydney for it. All companies.
And what would you ask them, Stephen?
Well, Centre Group is a good story because when COVID hit, they were claiming they had net assets of like $23 billion. And the market cap got to as low as $10 billion. So they were literally had this wildly inaccurate market cap of NTA versus what the market was saying. Now they've clawed it back to basically $18 billion each. So they didn't panic. They didn't do a discounted capital raising. They didn't do a $10 billion write-off just because the share price jerked down when all the shopping centres were closed. They stayed calm and carried on. And I'm going to say, well done, Centre Group. You've got your market cap back to match your net assets, so your Westfields are not overvalued in your books anymore, and you continue to be a magnificently successful owner of 42 very large shopping centres. Keep up the good work.
42. Do you shop at the Westfield in Doncaster?
I do. It's worth $1.8 billion. Our largest ratepayer. They give us about $3.3 million a year. I say we should value you at what you claim you're worth, not what we claim you're worth, because we only value them at about 1.3 and they claim they're worth 1.8, but there's some technicality about valuations and rates, which means we have to cop the lower valuation.
Right. Before we move to questions, here's a quick word from our sponsor.
Is it time to brush up on your investing skills and knowledge? Well, InvestSmart's Investor Bootcamp is for you. Learn the fundamentals of investing, how to form better money habits, and what it takes to build long-term wealth. Do it at your own pace over 3 months, with the option to participate in live weekly webinars to consolidate your learning. Usually $99, Money Cafe listeners can get $40 off with the code MONEY40. Visit investsmart.com.au/bootcamp and use MONEY40 to save $40.
David says, I've been mulling over house prices and all this talk of supply and demand. Can't understand why there's incentives for buying a house when it's meant to be a free market. Is there a chance the government could walk back incentives and allow renters to buy homes? Seems like the investment would come over time, naturally, with renters turning into homeowners. How long do you see it taking if this was to play out? Working in the building industry over the last 20 years, I can't see how the industry could have built more homes and into the future supply going backwards now. Well,
I don't think you can withdraw incentives for first home buyers in particular and things that increase demand such as stamp duty holidays when you buy off the plan.
No, but he seems to be suggesting rent to buy as becoming standard, that people who are renters get to buy the house they're renting as a matter of course in some way. I'm not sure how that would work, David. I think there are some people who do rent to buy, some developers allow you to...
Well, build to rent is a growing thing.
No, I'm talking about rent to buy, where renter gets to buy the place.
Yeah, but the government needs to be involved in that.
I don't know how that's going to work.
There's a number of issues. I just think that we need to remove the incentives for large-scale negative gearing just to get
We are in furious agreement about that.
I'd cap it at two houses. You can only own your own house plus two more, and then there's no more negative gearing. Something like that just capped it. And then we just
What'll I do with my 10-house portfolio,
Stephen?
Well,
there you go, Alan. You'll receive less... You'll keep it, Alan, but you'll just get less support from the tax office.
Just before everyone starts writing in, I do not own 10 houses. That's a joke. Yes. But the other point...
You're down to your last two, aren't you, I think?
The other point David makes is I think it's an interesting point about he's in the building industry and he can't see how the industry could have built more homes. I think that's an interesting point because the one of the big problems with housing in Australia is the capacity of the building industry to keep up because not enough people, there's not enough capacity. They can't build enough homes.
I agree. I think it's a supply solution. I think the government should be getting in there and contributing to new supply. We need more flexible labour markets in the migrant schemes.
I reckon one of the problems, Stephen, is that the building industry is a shocker for builders. It's terrible.
Oh, you keep going broke. It's high risk. It's chunky revenue.
Well, they have to do that. Yeah, that's right.
Who would be a builder now?
Yeah. And it'd be just terrible because you have to bid a fixed price, right?
Yeah.
You've got a fixed price to build the house.
Yeah.
And God knows what's going to happen in the 12 months it's going to take to build it. And you get caught.
Yeah, I agree. Now James thinks our MMT coverage is off the mark, and amidst many points, he reminds us that, quote, whilst a government that controls the issuance of its currency can never run out of money, it can certainly run out of resources.
Well, that, James and Stephen, is the central point of modern monetary theory, is that the only
print until you run out of resources.
That's one way to put it, but another way, the way that it's put in the idea is that the only constraint on issuing money is the resources of the economy to supply the demand.
Yeah, that's right. And if you overprint with limited resources, you get inflation. So basically,
that's the idea. That's the whole idea, James. You have hit it in one. Well done.
Yeah. So, well, the other day you put up on the news this graph showing that the total government debt is $82 trillion.
Correct. US dollars.
Yeah.
Real money.
I'm saying why don't some of those governments that have a capacity to print, why don't they just start writing some of that off? Just print, pay it back and write it off. Because it's never going to get repaid. It's not owed to Mars. It's owed to other people in the world. And it's just a fiction that it will ever actually be paid off, particularly the printed element done by the US.
Correct.
So why doesn't the US Reserve, just Federal Reserve, just...
Well, maybe they will eventually.
Write it off, yeah.
But I know, maybe they will eventually. Yeah. But yes, it's $82 trillion US dollars.
Yes. Now, we've got multiple questions ripping into James Get the Facts Thompson and his defence of Coles and
Woolies. Surely he's got to be here to defend himself.
I'm just going to say that we're going to deal with one of them. Because, I mean, look, James is the number one independent defender of Coles and Woolies in the public debate at the moment. So he has put a bit of an arrow on his back when there's a feeding frenzy with both political parties. A target on his back, yeah. Hit by lots of arrows. I think good on him for actually standing up for business. And I think he's making some fair points. But this particular questioner is just saying, how can they have the highest margins in the world, you know, when the likes of... The US giant Walmart has a margin of 2.55% and Coles and Woolies get away with 3%, the highest in the world. Why is that? And particularly given this big wide brown land and the logistics of actually servicing the whole country. So, look, I think their record margins are because of their market power, because it's a concentrated market. I think that's just a statement of fact, and they're probably making 10 to 20% too much relative to if there was a competitive market in Australia.
Well, so, I know, but James says that they're philanthropists, you know.
Well, he says they're trying to $2.70 and $100 is not over the top.
$2.60 and $100
is. Yeah, so I personally think the the bigger problem is our big banks. I think that they are gouging more. They're making $40 billion a year in profit, and they're worth like more than $400 billion. Coles and Woolies are only worth about $65, $70 billion. I mean, it's still quite tasty, but I don't think it's as big a scandal as the big four banks.
Mitch says, I'm wanting to vote sensibly in an upcoming AGM. Is there a mechanism whereby decision makers can be held accountable for their decisions more than 5 years out? Is that even fair? The trouble is that in making large investment decisions, the future value of present shares can vary enormously. Yes, well, I agree, of course.
We all agree that you should be held to account for your long-term decisions. And the best example, I would say, of someone who was making short-term decisions was when Alan Joyce tried to effectively take hundreds of millions of dollars of prepaid COVID airfares by saying, if you use it or lose it. And that would have increased his profit as he was heading out the door. So I love the Macquarie model, where they pay very small cash salaries, very small cash bonuses, and sort of 90% of the pay is long-term incentive vesting of shares, which is restricted for 7 years or up to 7 years. So if something goes wrong in the next 7 years, they are unable to cash out of their bonus paid
shares.
Good stuff. Good stuff, Macquarie. Everyone should have that long-term restricted share model. Now, Tyler says that the love of the show keeps me interested at work. I've done my best to find household income statistics for 1990 when the cash rate and presumably mortgage rates peaked at 17%. The best I can find is 1994-95, and based on those numbers, it looks like the average household with the average mortgage is now doing it at least as tough as people did in 1990 in terms of repayments as a percentage of household income. Alan, I loved your quarterly essay on housing, but wondered why you came up with your own metric for household income. Was it because stats are a bit difficult to find for household income back then?
I didn't come up with my own. What's he talking about? I didn't do that. Tyler, come on. It is true. I mean, yeah, it's true that on the ABS website, the average weekly wage only goes back to 94. November 94 is the earliest average weekly age you can get on the ABS website. But if you use that, right, the average weekly wage in 1994 was $36,000, and the median house price in 1994 was $111,000, which was three times the weekly wage, right? Times 52 for the annual wage. So three times. Now the average weekly wage is $100,000 and the national median house price is $770,000. So 7.7 times. So that's the whole central point of the essay, is that that over the past 25 years, actually it started changing in 2000, is over the last 25 years, the ratio of house price to income has gone from three times to seven times. But that's the whole. That's the central point of the essay.
That's right. But when the official interest rate peaked at 17%, wasn't that even tougher because of the mortgage servicing cost from a household income point of view at the time?
Sure, it was really tough.
Because all these people these days are listening to their parents say, "Stop whinging, kid. When I was a kid, our mortgage rates peaked at 17%." You don't know anything about this 6.8%.
So true.
But it was only fleeting. It wasn't there for very long.
But what the mortgage rate doesn't sort of deal with is the problem of the deposit. So in those days, you could actually save a deposit.
Yeah.
The house price wasn't so high that you but these days there's no possibility of people saving
for a deposit.
And
the total size of the mortgage book back then was a fraction of what it is today. And that was particularly because we didn't really have super very well developed, and so everyone was just using the paying off the mortgage as your primary savings tool. And so yes, the mortgage rate was massive, but the actual balance sheet of those borrowing back then was a lot stronger than those particularly who've entered the housing market more recently.
Jack says, J-A-C-Q, can you help me understand the lack of discussion around better public transport solving the housing crisis? We bought our first family home in New South Wales Central Coast during COVID. moving out of Sydney, and we love it, but the commute is clearly a barrier for most, 1.5 hours on the train. If they did the high-speed rail and reduced that by half, then there are so many more suburbs with plenty of land. That is, in fact, where I got to in the quarterly essay. At the end of it, I said, well, we need to have faster trains to open up more land.
Couldn't agree more.
There you are.
English style, French style, fast trains. That means that you can live in Bendigo, Ballarat, Geelong, you know, Canberra,
Bathurst, Toowoomba,
all those countries, all those inland towns, and you can get to the capital city in less than an hour.
Sure.
So I completely agree that we should have invested more. The geography is tough, particularly getting into Brisbane and Sydney. You know, the it's very expensive. So they're
going to just on the essay, if I may, just put in a plug now.
Record sales, hey.
Oh, record sales.
Selling?
It's still selling. I'm making money out of it.
Royalty checks coming in, are they?
Yes, they are.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Oh, your shout today.
No, but hang on. Wait, there's more. They've decided to issue it as a paperback.
Oh, you're kidding.
And I have to...
update it?
I have to write more.
Oh, that's...
Because the paperback has to be thicker.
Yes.
Has to be fatter than a quarterly essay, so I'm going to write some more.
Because you get to add a few more reflections, weave in some of the reaction, update on the latest stats.
No, well, I've decided what I'm going to do is I'm going to firstly write about homelessness, which I didn't in the quarterly essay, and, you know, write... Because the thing is that a lot of the debate gets mixed up between affordable social housing for homeless people and the question of housing affordability for middle-class families, which are two separate things which overlap, right? Because the lack of affordable housing for homeless people leads to a sort of a shortage of housing generally, but it's a different issue. And separately, I'm going to look at lessons from overseas.
So when are we going to be able to read this, and how big is it going to be?
Well, I don't know. I've just started adding to it, and my deadline is the beginning of June.
Excellent. So this is like, so you've got a sequel. This is like Die Hard 5 or something. This could become an annual franchise for you, Alan, on the biggest hit, the biggest selling quarterly essay ever. Goes into its own paperback?
It might well be. I don't know. I haven't been told that, but yes, it's certainly...
Well, look, congratulations. That is amazing, and that means that we can keep taking questions on your essay at least for the next year, because it's been the most reverberating question topic we've had for the last 9 months as well.
So
Every week we get one.
And I can have another launch and get drunk again.
You'll get a bit croaky if you do that. So.
No, that's true.
Now, Josh says, you spoke last week of the younger generation having such a bleak view of the future. As a way to address this inequality, why aren't we looking at long-term leases like other countries do? That way, those who won't ever be able to afford to buy can at least be able to make their rental a home. It's really no different in the workforce, is it? Contracts versus permanency. People want security so they can family plan or plan for the future. I would support a rule that says if you do a three-year lease or more as a landlord, we won't tax you as much. Some sort of a tax incentive for long-term tenancy.
You're an ideas man, Stephen.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yes, but we'll largely take that as a comment from Josh. But look, it is a problem. Now, Ben says with the... You love chocolate.
Well, Ben says, with the huge rise in the price of chocolate lately and concerns over climate change increasing, I was wondering if Australia should pivot to producing more chocolate and less coal. It'd be great. It'd be great for the environment, and we'd still make a fortune in exports, but people would just be a bit happier, I reckon. So, yeah, look, it's actually cocoa that's gone up. It's above $10,000 US a tonne. It's kind of tripled, I think, in a few years. Look, I don't know. The price of chocolate presumably will go up on the back of that.
But why aren't we growing cocoa? I mean, it needs tropical climate. So there was a little bit up near the Daintree in FNQ, Far North Queensland.
It's all grown in Africa.
Yeah. But why?
I don't know.
I think there's a labour issue, that it's quite labour intensive, and they have all that very, all the child exploitation scandals from over the years. It's quite a labour intensive crop, and we can't compete. But surely with the price as high as it is, some of our FNQ sugarcane farmers could pivot to cocoa more than they currently have, and we'd have a thriving, top of the market cocoa industry.
I love it. Make chocolate, not coal. I'm in favour of that.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. Now, Matt says, love the show, but I strongly disagree with James and Alan saying it's impossible for young people to buy a house without the bank of mum and dad.
Back to this again.
Yeah. All right. Actually, we'll move on because.
No, but. Well, actually, there's another one.
Well, he's saying that stop depressing everyone by saying it's impossible to buy a house. If you're on 150, of course you can buy a house. And look, I basically agree.
No, there is not
too much doomsday
true.
Chat. There's too much doomsday chat now.
I spent my Easter preparing a spreadsheet in which I calculated how much house prices in each capital city need to fall in order to become affordable. This is for people on average weekly earnings. And the answer across Australia is 40%. For affordable being spending 30% of your income on mortgage repayments.
Yeah. So we need the $10 trillion worth of housing stock in Australia to gently glide down to $7 trillion with a $3 trillion wealth wipeout for all current owners.
No. We just
to make it affordable for those who are not currently in the market.
We need house prices not to change for a while so incomes catch up. I understand what you're saying. We don't want house prices to fall.
To crash.
That'd be bad.
I personally think that a 10 to 15% drop in house prices to 9 trillion from 10 trillion in terms of the value of the stock would be a healthy thing, which we could afford that sort of a correction.
We got a 9% fall in house prices in 2022. Yeah. And
we should have kept that. So it's gone back up again. So
it's gone back up again by 9%.
Yeah, but we do have another question later on, which we may as well deal with now, is someone saying that HEX is unfair and that universities should be forced to better explain the liability that their prospective 17, 18-year-old students are taking on and that the students should be given mandatory fiscal competency training just to know the size of their debt, because you sign up for a degree and suddenly you're left with $80,000 debt, which hangs over you for the rest of your life. So I actually think that HEX is almost the biggest generational inequity, because so many of, you know, anyone over 55 got a free education from university, and now there's a $70 billion debt index to inflation, and young people just look at that and go, what chance have I got with this massive HEX debt and totally unaffordable housing? And their grandparents and many of their parents did not have that same liability.
Is yeah, well,
fair?
The answer is don't go to university.
Well, I think a lot of people are going to start making that choice.
Yeah, well, and, you know, become a carpenter. Build houses. Well, we need houses.
Yeah.
Chris says, this is a question for you, really. Should I join the BHP class action concerning alleged non-disclosure of risk over the tailings dam disaster in Brazil? The shares which qualify me to join the class action were sold at a capital gain several years ago, but I'll hold another tranche of BHP shares. Would registering for the class action essentially be a case of cutting off my nose to spite my face? The documentation accompanying the registration form assures me that I won't be liable for any costs should a settlement or award be made. But if the case drags on and BHP bleeds cash trying to defend itself, the value of my current shareholding will be dragged down. All ruminations will be gratefully received.
Okay,
so ruminate, will you?
Okay, so Chris, generally the class action industry and their sort of, you know, litigation funders and class action lawyers like, say, a Maurice Blackburn, which is the most successful, they take the risk and fund the case. So it is a free ride for participating shareholders to sign up for a class action. So I would generally say, you know, if it's a credible firm, you don't lose anything by signing up, and you will get yourself a tiny slice of the settlement.
But what about this bloke who's just made money from his BHP shares, sold them at a profit?
Yeah.
So how does he get the line up for
it? Well, that's right. Well, the point is that you have to have sold or bought the shares in the relevant period. So if they're sending it, hopefully the class action ambulance chasing firm is smart enough to not be sending it to ineligible shareholders. So hopefully they're good enough to do their spreadsheet data management for that. But it is a bit of a case of 2 + 2 = 5, this game. You're not sort of suing yourself, because 90% of the settlements come from the insurers. So the shareholders don't actually pay. It's the insurance companies that pay, although obviously the premiums go up over time. So overall, I would probably say you may as well go in. The dam disaster was an absolute catastrophe, and BHP, you know, deserves to be sued for that. And they've still got the Brazilian authorities going them for tens of billions of dollars.
Have they?
Yeah. Oh, it's a Shocker. Absolute shocker. They haven't had as much bad publicity as they deserve for the disaster of their dam collapse.
I think we've got one more time for one more question. We should go with Russell's.
Russell, with Armaguard on the verge of insolvency, isn't it time to acknowledge just how expensive it is to transact in cash by adding a cash surcharge at the till? It's unfair to add a card surcharge while not doing the same for cash. I'm sick of cash proponents going on about how cash doesn't have any transaction costs. It's never been true. They've just been absorbed by the business and passed through to all consumers as higher prices. I'm curious to know what the cash surcharge would need to be to cover the typical cash handling costs for a retailer.
I reckon Russell's onto something there.
Totally agree.
I mean,
pay more if you pay cash. I like that.
Yeah, I do too.
It makes sense because the only reason people do cash is, you know, often discount is because they're dodging tax and they're black economy players. Local Thai restaurant I'm aware of, you know, 10% less if you pay cash. And, you know, I should say, but doesn't that cost you more to handle my cash?
I mean, our butcher hasn't taken cash for about 5 years, I think. I mean, he just won't take cash because it's dirty.
Yeah, well, I parked at the MCG to go and see Richmond beat the Swans the other day, and they don't take cash. The MCG, world's biggest sporting club, managing Yarra Park when City of Melbourne got kicked off managing Yarra Park. They gave it over to a private cricket club, which refuses to take cash for people parking on the government-owned park that they manage. So I agree. I think cash is gone and should go. And I do love the fact that Lindsay Fox, he's worth $5 billion and he's sort of going, Armaguard's going to go broke. Lindsay, you're fine, mate. You're worth $5 billion. You're losing money on a few contracts with the banks. They're big boys. You're a big boy. Just honour your contract or renegotiate, but don't go and tell the Reserve Bank and others that you're about to collapse without some sort of bailout because you're a rich bloke and you don't need a bailout.
He owns
Armaguard.
Entirely, 100%.
Yeah, privately. And he's worth $5 billion. And he's running around as if it's a sort of a precarious small business that needs a handout. He's one of the richest blokes in Australia and he should just honour his contracts as opposed to threatening to shut Armaguard down or asking the Reserve Bank for a bailout.
Oh, I think it's a disgrace.
And I think the big four banks should pay him more to keep Armaguard solvent. Maybe they should buy the whole of Armaguard because it's the banks who do mainly need the cash in all their bank branches.
But then they'd be colluding.
We can't have that out. Yes. But the banks are worth $400 billion for a reason. It's because they don't, you know, roll over when a Lindsay Fox comes along and says, give us a better deal. They're hard mongrels, the banks, and they're being hard mongrels to Lindsay, and he's having a whinge.
There you go, everybody. Stephen has summed it up for you. Okay, very good. Thank you for listening to today's episode of Money Cafe at the Short Straw Cafe in Hawthorne. I'll be back next week with James Thompson, or is it Stephen Mayne next week?
No. It's Tomo. Get the facts.
Tomo. It's Tomo.
Supporter of Coles and Woolies.
Send in your question and we'll answer it together by emailing to themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au. Till then, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report, which is Inside Intelligent Investor now.
And I'm Stephen Mayne, fortnightly columnist for Intelligent Investor, if any of you would like to subscribe for the excellent product. And we'll see you in a fortnight.